Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up. If they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello, everyone. Page Tyson Jackson. I'm Tim Howie, Andrew on the board. S&P futures. We're rallying a little bit here today. After 2 days of being down, but not very much. We're down just a little bit. Let me see what we're doing here this morning. Computer's a little bulky. We have Mr. Professor Kevin.
Yeah, good morning.
How are you?
You have me here.
S&P futures up 18, NASDAQ futures up 187. Can't be down a few days in a row, Kevin. That's the job of our Fed now, to keep the market up, and you know most people would agree with that. So anyway, I'm not so sure that most people are correct on that, but whatever. For the short term, I think, for the short term, it's now pretty long term. They're doing a pretty good job at it, so that's the deal. So how are you?
Doing all right. You know, kind of right in the middle of the last week before I have to go back to work next week.
I hate it when you have to go back to work. You've been golfing? You've been doing anything? You've been kayaking?
I've been out on the boat several times. I have I've gotten some chores done. Tomorrow night I will... The local alumni club has a Notre Dame football preview. So, and then Tim Priester from whatever publication he is nowadays is going to be the speaker. So I'll learn all about the Irish football team.
Well, good.
I got stuff to do.
How long?
Had people over here a couple of times. Just hanging out.
I did not get an invite to any of those things.
I told you last week. I said, just come on over.
How am I going to fit in with a bunch of professors?
Well, you could have come last week when my brother and his family came over.
Well, that would be nice. That would have been very nice, actually. How long before alumni of all shapes and sizes somehow get the feeling that their school is going to stay somewhat different than the racing Pall Mall into full professional things like the Bears? I mean, they're almost like no difference at this point, I don't think.
You like to always say you can't be half a gangster, so you're either in the game as it's played today or you're not.
I don't know why some things hit people and other things don't, but I'll tell you what,
Before you do that, You can still take the educational mission seriously. You can have your students, go to class, make progress towards a meaningful degree, earn a meaningful degree, all of those kinds of things. And, that's still possible in the college sports world today. And there are still some schools that do that.
And there's some kids that do that.
And there are lots of kids that do that, yeah.
I would agree with that, but it's really hard to when somebody's making $45,000 a month or whatever. Shanny was telling me one of the basketball players was down at Vanderbilt or someplace. It's pretty hard to go at and say, boy, you have no idea how important your sociology grade is. You're at that point. I guess there's going to be a few kids that say, well, I'm only going to do this for a little while. I'm really going to be a doctor, but boy, I don't know how widespread that's going to be.
Well, there aren't that many that are saying I'm really going to be a doctor, although we've seen a few of those historically too. But you will see people who see the value of having, whether it's a business degree or another type of degree. There's a lot of people, especially a lot of smart smart kids, and they know this going in. That you know they choose like, Marcus Freeman likes to use the mantra: choose hard. You know, choose to come and do the work. If you don't choose that, fine, and you can go someplace else. But there's a lot that see the value of having, for example, a business degree, because there's a lot, if they go on to professional football career or basketball career or whatever, there is a lot to manage there. And if you want to just turn that over to somebody else and trust them, go ahead. But there, you know, the world is full of stories where that didn't work out really well. So I think people who have the education behind them that will help them manage their own affairs through advisors, agents, whoever, but know what they're doing and can sit down with them and really understand everything and provide direction. I think there's a lot of people who see the value in that. They look at the opportunities that they may have to earn a ton of money, and are saying, I want to walk away from this sport with a ton of money.
Well, I don't doubt any of that. I just, you know, it seems to me though in a huge, and again, we're both kind of generalizing, and I hope you're the one who's right, by the way, is I remember, the whole thrust for kids who, you and I have talked forever about every kid in high school thinks he's going to be a pro, right? Hell, every kid in grammar school thinks he's going to be a pro if he's a little bit better than the guy down the block. Well, and they're all idiots, pretty much, because the pyramid is so dramatic, and the parents are dumb enough to egg them on, okay? So it's going to be one kid in the whole neighborhood. I mean, like my cousin said, if you're not all state, if you're not all American, you know, you're not going to be the guy, with few exceptions. But I remember who was the guy? Here's a trivia question. You know this. There's only been two sport all Americans in the same year in the history of Notre Dame. Can you name them?
Well, Kevin Hardy would have been one of them. No,
I
am absolutely certain that. Golic, not Mike Golic, Bob Golic, Buzz.
I think it was Mike. Bob was the...
It was Bob. Bob was the wrestler. He was an All-American wrestler.
Announcer? The announcer, Mike?
Is the younger brother. He's the guy who's on the channels all the time.
He's saying it's ESPN. He's had a huge career at ESPN.
Well, I don't know that he works for ESPN anymore, but nevertheless.
He's real good.
Bob Golic, who played a long time for the Cleveland Browns and other teams in the NFL, but it was Bob that was the All-American wrestler.
He was on the Oakland team with Zato and all those guys. He was older than us.
No, he was younger than us.
The older one?
Bob Golic.
I think he was like a senior when I was a sophomore or something. But I'm not positive. I know he played for the Oakland teams. The other playing middle guard. He played linebacker for Notre Dame. And somehow or another, the guy dropped down from like 230 to wrestle 195 in like a month or something, didn't he? I don't know how he did that. But anyway, yeah, he was, you know, the other one was Moose Kraus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Moose Kraus was an All-American basketball player and football player. Yeah. That's right.
Anyway, but the Golic, when they said, what about your education in Notre Dame? He goes, I was there to be a pro player. He goes, I don't remember any of that crap, basically. And I think... Which is okay, because he's had, you know, I don't think he's had the announcing career and what he did after football, but his brother obviously had a terrific career.
Well, he actually did some acting.
Okay, yeah, I mean, he's no dummy. But
yeah, his first year in the NFL was 1979. So
okay, he's a little younger than us then. Okay,
yeah.
But he was,
and he had a 14-year NFL career.
Well, yeah, he was terrific.
And made three Pro Bowls, so he did all right for himself.
We got you. But I'm saying, I think we that whole thing about you did all this stuff to become a pro, we basically yanked that back 4 years to a lot of younger people. And I don't, with all the pluses and minuses to that, Kevin, because now you don't have to be, you don't have to play for the Bears to make money in football. You can play for a college team, but now the people are 18 instead of 22, with all its vagaries. I won't say good or bad. It's just different. So now a kid in high school can say, you know, I'm going to make this money playing ball in college. Maybe if he's got the right upbringing and he's the right kid, he's going to say, and, oh, by the way, I get this terrific education on the side sort of thrown in. But you're going to have a lot of kids like that, as you say, and hopefully the majority. I just wonder if it really is. You know, I mean, because it has taken the decision process back from somebody who's 22 to somebody who's 18, which, as you know, we still remember what we were like when we were 18 into 22. That's a dangerous thing with a young male, isn't it? And even maybe a young female.
You know, yeah, there would be God's way of telling you to make too damn much money.
Yeah, yeah. And just remember what Nick at Nick and Vito's, Tripoli Tap, spent 90% of my money on women, booze, and fast cars. The other 10% I wasted. Anyway, did you watch any of the Cub game last night? And I have a thing here. As you know, we're always kind of jousting on stats of the world. And I came across a good one yesterday. Before that, did you watch any of the Cub game last night?
Yeah, I watched it.
The very interesting. Did you see the chart about how young the Nationals are?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're a bunch of babies. I think they have one guy that's, you know, like 28, and everybody else is younger than that.
They of course, they because they know how to do computers like you and Colonel, they dug back and they went through the history of baseball. And at this time of the year, they took the youngest teams. And I think, was it 27, Kevin, or 20? How many hits on the team, how many hits did the team have by people over 27?
Or was it multiple hit games or whatever it was? It was just one.
Yeah, but it was just hits by people over 27. And all these other really young teams, they had the Seattle when those guys were young, and by this time of the year, everybody was in the 200s of, you know, hits by people over 27. These guys have one. Did you see the replay of the hit?
Say that again?
Did you see the replay of the one hit?
No, I don't remember it. I might not have been paying close attention at that
point. I don't know what caught my eye about that one. The replay of the one, they got this, like, 37-year-old pitcher who actually pitched last night.
Oh, yeah, it was Miles Michaelis, wasn't it?
Yeah, they sent him up there to bunt.
It was a squeeze bunt.
Yeah, they sent him up there to bunt, and the guy was safe at the plate, and they didn't get it down to first base in time, so they gave him a hit.
Yeah, I did see that. Now I do remember.
That's pretty wild. They had a... I have two more baseball questions, because I love to talk baseball. One was, it was on YouTube yesterday, and I found it. There's a play where the guy hits the ball. There's men at first and third with one out. The guy whacks the ball out to center field. They had put, somehow or another, the scoreboard guy had put two outs on the scoreboard when there only was one. This is a major league game.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Keep going. Tell the story.
So the guy whacks the ball at the center field. The guy catches it. The batter's had all taken off. And the guy from third crossed home plate. He had the sense enough to touch the plate. So they come in and everybody's going, hey, there's only two outs, you idiots. So they throw the ball over to first base, and they get that guy out. Question is, does the run score?
No, actually, it was the guy on third.
No, they got the guy on first out.
Okay, whatever it was double play.
Yeah. The question is, does the run score?
Or theoretically, was it double play?
Well, no, it was. It definitely was. Because they left early, and they should have known it was one out, even though the scoreboard said two. So that was the third out, is at first base. The question is, does the run score?
And it seems to me that the run did. I have to see that whole thing again, but my understanding was that the run was allowed to score because they had run off the field.
No, the run was allowed to score because they threw the ball to first base, and the run had already scored before the third out was registered. If they had thrown the ball to third base, it wouldn't have scored. Because they could have forced him out. They didn't. They forced the wrong guy out.
Tom, I got to look at that one, and maybe I will when we take a break, because I think, you know, if you get a guy out, there was something to an appeal. An appeal was part of it. I don't remember. I saw it.
Yeah, the appeal was the first. It should have been the third.
Yeah, well, but there's a difference between an appeal and just a straight force out, because if they would have thrown the ball directly to first, wouldn't have mattered. It would have been like lining into a double play in the infield.
Okay, well, anyway, on the YouTube, the guy said because the run had scored before they got the guy at first out, it counts, is what the guy said. Now, he could be wrong, but I guess it was like a five-minute delay while the umps talked about it. And then the part about the scoreboard having the wrong thing up there, that complicated everything, of course, which it probably shouldn't have, but it did. Anyway, I have one here. It's sort of, you know, this is all kind of in the what if world. The there was a chance at one time of a head up trade between Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams. They were sort of contemporaries, I think. The question is,
overlapped a lot.
Yeah, and the question is, how would that have? And you don't think about this too much when you go back into the stats, because now that we're statting like there's no tomorrow. The thing they sort of leave out is the ballpark when they talk about this guy WAR and this guy's a better hitter than that guy and all that kind of crap. They leave out the part, where the hell are you playing? And so the idea was that DiMaggio, and he was a right-handed power hitter, and Yankee Stadium at the time had this huge cavernous center and left center field, where Fenway Park obviously is 310 feet, and then you got to go higher, but everything hits the wall is probably a double. Where Ted Williams in left field at Fenway is pretty long, and Yankee Stadium was pretty short. But some of the stats that they pile out here is pretty interesting. Joe DiMaggio is one of the few people that are power hitters that hit way more home runs on the road than they did at home, because of the place he hit the ball was where balls went to die in Yankee Stadium. And I dug up, Roberto Clemente was the same way, because he played in Forbes Field, which was what, 410 down the line and 475 at a power alley or something?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you wonder how much that absolutely sort of plays into, you know, what people, the stats on this stuff, and how it would have made difference for a lot of these guys. I mean, they still would have been the best player in the field. The question is, what would the stats be different? And this guy was claiming it would have been a way bigger difference for DiMaggio's stats than it would have been for Ted Williams.
Might have been, because Williams didn't use the short left field very often. But that's also a different kind of home run that you have to hit there, because you know, DiMaggio may have just hit a whole bunch of doubles off the wall.
Yeah, could be.
Because you really have to lift to get it out of there.
Well, they said that the evidence for this shift lies in the actual home run and road splits. Over his 13-season career, DiMaggio had 361 home runs, a staggering 213 of them were on the road. Only 148 were in the Bronx. This is the most extreme home road power disparities in baseball history for a star player. So, I mean, it's nothing you can do about it. They're all dead. But, I mean, it is interesting when you go back and I remember I saw this the first time, Kevin. You've been down to spring training a few times in Arizona. And I went to a bunch of the parks. And the ball carries more out there, right? I mean, a little bit, anyway. So one night I go see the Cubs play at Diablo Stadium. I think it's still there. I forget who the home team was. I look out there and I'm going, God, that's a long way. Center field was like 460 or something. The outfield was like, I'm sitting there going, boy, if I'm a scout, if I see anybody that plays in this park that hit 20 home runs, I want to grab the guy. He's got to be Babe Ruth, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So some of it is, I think a lot of the hockey, actually had a hockey guy on one day, years ago. And they said, what about the road advantage? Or what about the advantage of being at home? He goes, back in the day, all the rinks were different. Because there was a huge advantage to being at home. Because now they're all the same. What's the difference? Remember, I mean,
oh, yeah. No, I'm completely, you know, I'm aware of that.
They were all
very different. Some were wider. Some were a little bit longer. And so, yes, you would learn your own rink and have a big advantage.
Well, you also, if you're going to have a bunch of big guys like beat people up, and you had a smaller rink, it was to your advantage. So I mean, it's the I don't know. You know, the Hawks were shorter, right? And the New York, the Rangers were narrower or something? I mean, they were all different sizes.
I don't remember what the Hawks was, but it seems to me it was narrower too.
Might have been, because they're supposed to be, what, 200 by something something. And they all were, and the Hawks, I think, were 188. And I remember the interesting one was the Canadians versus the Maple Leafs. I remember, I used to watch hockey when I was a kid, like, religiously. Now I don't really care, but I don't know why that's all happened. But the Maple Leafs, their whole style was, when you got to the blue line, you wung the ball, you shot the puck into the corner, and it would hit into the corner, and it would bounce out kind of in front of the net. So you would fire in, and you try and pick the thing up. They were a big forechecking team. That was their big deal. They try and stop you in the middle, wing it in there, and chase it. Well, the rink, I think, was essentially the same dimensions as Montreal's. But Montreal had all these real fast skaters. The radius in the corner was real narrow. It was like almost like a square. I mean, it was just enough curvature in the corner to make a corner. Where the Toronto one, you know, started further out, and it was a much, you know, almost like a railroad turn. So the actual amount of square footage of ice was way less in Toronto than it was in Montreal, even though I think they were allegedly the same length and width. So it was more than just the length and width.
Yeah, it was the depth of the corners, and the angle of them. Yeah, I remember that being part of the equation as well. So a couple of things, much as I hate to say it, you're right about the tag-up play. It is, the explanation is that it's not considered a force play at first base, it is considered a time play. And so as a time play, because the runner from third had crossed home plate before they forced out doubled up the runner at first, he was allowed to score. And I think you're right. I think if they had thrown to third instead of first, that would have negated the run.
Well, at least he was smart enough to touch the plate.
Oh, yeah. He ran all the way through it. Yeah, but, you know, that's partly because he thought there were two outs, I guess. But now, that part two, because you mentioned DiMaggio and Williams, you know, I am a big fan of Ted Williams as a hitter. He is, like, to me, is the ideal hitter, because Ted Williams was insistent on always getting a good pitch to hit. And Williams, he is 10th in all-time batting average. Everybody ahead of him is not from his era. So you're looking at the people ahead of him: Ty Cobb, Oscar Charleston, Rogers Hornsby, Joe Jackson, Judd Wilson, Lefty O'Doul, et cetera. And, you know, before you get down to Williams, who is a post-World War II or a, you know, World War II and later guy. And Babe Ruth, for example, is 13th on that list. But as you start to look at some of the others, you look at on-base percentage, Williams is first, and it ain't close. He's 0.4817 to Babe Ruth's 0.4739. So almost a full percentage point, which over a career and the number of times they bat is significant, because it would take a lot to close that gap. In terms of slugging and slugging percentage, you find Williams is second only to Ruth, which is amazing. When you start going to a few others, on base plus slugging, again, it's Ruth, and then it's Ted Williams. When you get to things like career, when you start getting into the career, the tally ones, you know, like home runs, well, you have to allow for the fact that Ted Williams twice served in the military, once during World War II, once during the Korean conflict. So he lost a lot of years to that. So when you start to look at base hits, that's where he starts going down the list. And that's why people tend to not realize how great he was, because he lost, I think, three full seasons to the military. But if you, you know, he also, as you start looking at things like doubles, so we start getting into extra base hits. And, you know, to me, it's more than home runs. I think extra base hits is important. And so when you look at something like doubles, you start to get Ted Williams in there. Where is he?
Well, I think one of the things we haven't mentioned on the show in a while is, maybe in fact ever, is from my own personal experience, I am so amazed. And Kevin, I played, you know, long after we left Notre Dame and stuff, I started playing a real lot of basketball. And I was playing, you know, 2-3 leagues a week and so forth. And I got to the point where I was marginally okay. When I say that, you know, mentally I was pretty good at it. I knew who everybody was covering who, and I knew who the open man was, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and I was always in condition more than anybody else, so in pickup leagues I could hang in there. I did better in the fourth quarter as I was in better shape. But all of a sudden, 1 or 2 years, you know, I stopped playing. And then a couple of guys said, well, let's go play. We got a couple of games tonight. How about playing? Kevin, I was horseshit. I lost everything in like a year or two. I can't imagine being a Major League Baseball player with all the skill set that is and not doing it for 2 years. Now, I'm sure the guy was able to play catch in the Air Force or something, but to go back and be able to do that again, I can't even imagine.
As he was, it's just it's a remarkable accomplishment.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that, stopping playing ball for 2 years and going back and being just as good. I'm like, good Lord. I mean, Staubach, different because, you know, when he was in the Air Force or in the Navy, I mean, he played in all their you know, their flag leagues and stuff, and he was still pretty active. Plus, he was, you know, 21 years old or 22. But I don't see how the hell somebody in their 30s goes and flies jets for 2 years and comes back and hits again. I mean, I can't even imagine that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And if you, again, when you look at all the tallies, the ones like home runs, he had 521 home runs. Give him his years back, he's undoubtedly a 600 home run guy. But here's the one that's interesting. He is still fourth in walks, bases on balls. Barry Bonds is first. And then Ricky Henderson, and then Babe Ruth, and then Ted Williams. The difference is that Bonds had 12,600 plate appearances. Ricky Henderson had 13,346. Babe Ruth had 10,628. And then you fall down to 97-92 for Ted Williams. And then Joe Morgan follows that, but you're back up to 11,000 plate appearances. So, you know, that was the big thing with Williams. Like I said, it was get a good pitch to hit, and just was refused to swing at crap, which is what I love in a hitter. So you throw that, you throw doubles and home runs to go with plate discipline, and I think you have just, you know, like as good a hitter as there ever was.
Well, I mean, the 2012 vision didn't hurt either. I mean, he had incredible. He had 2012 or 2013 eyesight.
Oh yeah, no. That when you start talking about athletic gifts, you know, we tend to think of speed, explosiveness, hand-eye coordination, you know, a lot of things, but vision is huge. In many sports, peripheral vision is huge. You know, that some people just have a broader feel of what's going on around them. And, you know, I don't know if that's based on where the eyes are placed or what, you know, in the head, what, you know, what it is. But, you know, if I can pick up a few feet on either side of me in hockey or basketball, you're almost just feeling where some of the other players are on the peripheral. But, you know, those are important athletic gifts, just like the ability to run fast and jump high.
I mean, it is, when you see this, it's the idea of being able to walk away and come back. I can't even, but he allegedly, and I don't think it's allegedly, I think it's true, wherever he took his original flight training, some down, you know, Pensacola or someplace, I'm sure they don't have prop planes anymore, but I think he still has the record of the, because they used to shoot at whatever billboards or something. I think he still has a record for shooting when he was training. I mean, the eyesight.
Yeah. So here's the deal. In World War II, it was 3 years of did not play. And then in Korean conflict, he only played 6 games in 52 and 37 games in 53 before coming back. So basically, he lost 5 years to...
It's a, you know... We're talking about the top of the gene pool. I saw Ricky Henderson one night, of all places, in a casino in Vegas. And before I even knew who he was, so something I don't recognize these guys. I see this guy walking by, and I'm going, wait a minute, who's that? I mean, it's been a while, but I'm saying 6'1", just a little heavier, muscular than somebody. He's basically a slender African-American guy, but not quite that slender. And as soon as you looked at him, you go, wait a minute. There is something special. I didn't even know who the hell it was. And somebody goes, "That's Ricky Henderson," and he still had the kind of the whippet figure, where you knew he was fast as hell, but he was just a little stronger than most people with that figure.
Yeah, wiry strong.
Yeah, just a little bit more, sort of like an Austin Carr kind of a thing. A guy like that, just a little 10-15 pounds heavier than you would expect for somebody, you know, that size. And that extra 10 or 15 pounds made all the difference. You know, it just does. I mean, some people, you look at it and you go, wait a minute, that guy's special. The same night, I also saw, what's his name? Fullback for Franco Harris. I don't think they were there together, but he comes wandering through. The backs get bigger and the linemen get smaller as they age, right? God, the guy looked like a refrigerator. He's just a massive man. Not real heavy, just up and down, like, oh, my God, how do you tackle this guy? He's huge. He had to be, when he played at, what, 230 maybe? He had to be 270 if he was an ounce when I saw him. You know, he had a couple extra on him, but not that much. His shoulders, I'm like, God, what's that, a 54 coat, for God's sake? I mean, it is stunning when you see these, and everybody goes, oh, I could do that. No, you can't. No, you can't. Actually, I saw, listen to your buddy, the coach, yesterday, Mike Ditka named the players he had most trouble playing against. It was pretty interesting. You know, the weird part is he and Butkus both named the same guy, Deacon Jones. And the best. But he also said Merlin Olsen was really something, and Lawrence Taylor. But he also put Alan Page in that group. He said the guy was never where you thought he was going to be. He had to be the best thinker on the field. He knew where the play was. He went to block him, he was already gone because he knew where the play was going. Because nothing is more embarrassing than to go to block a guy and all you do is hit air. It's a whole different view of the world because tight ends have all kinds of these different blocking assignments, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they have to. You know, sometimes it's an end, sometimes they got to go get a linebacker. And he goes, the guy was, you couldn't find the guy. he already knew where the play was and he was already gone. And he said Merlin Olsen was amazingly strong. But it didn't matter. He just, if you wanted to get your hands into him, you couldn't. If you wanted, his footwork was always perfect, and he was strong as an ox. He goes, these guys are. He goes, they're just special. Those are the guys that when you show up on the field, you look across and you go, that's the guy I got to worry about. Out of all those people, and he put Joe Montana in there when he was coaching. He goes, you'd sit there and you'd design this play. You have it perfectly defended, and all of a sudden, what, a half a second before somebody strangles the guy, he finds this guy open and it's gone. You're like, how the hell did he do that? He had a calmness about him. Nothing ever ruffled him. He always kept thinking. He always kept looking. At the last minute, just when you think you had him, all of a sudden his ball pops out of there and lands in somebody's hands. He never let the game overwhelm him. He goes, and you look at the guy, you didn't think he was even a football player. It's amazing what people remember. You
know, that was Joe Montana in college. There's a reason he was a third round pick and not a first round pick. It really wasn't as much talent as he could be wildly erratic. Now, what I remember of Joe Montana as a college player is that he could have some really bad halves, but he never had a whole bad game. So, and that speaks to what you're talking about, that, you know, that he had a calm to him. Where, you know, when things were on the line, then he was calm and he was ready to compete. It is a comparison I have made, and really it took him a while playing for Bill Walsh to sort of get that consistency in in the early parts of a game, you know, to really start to establish the consistency. And there's, you know, there's some documentary out there that gets into this and how Walsh worked with him. But as soon, you know, as soon as he became, you know, a 60-minute consistent quarterback, then you had all of those comebacks at the end. In fact, his nickname in college was Comeback Kid. So, he did a lot of it. He had quite a few of them. And I was thinking the same thing about Caleb Williams is, you know, they're different in terms of what their talent is like. But Williams had that same thing where he was, you know, and we saw this last year, where he was wildly erratic. But even his first year, he led some comebacks, you know, where, you know, it, once the game was on the line, then he was at his best. And so the mission for Caleb Williams this year is getting that consistency at the beginning of the game, to have him ready for the end of the game and to not really need it as often at the end of the game, where he has to pull a rabbit out of his hat.
Once, I think what is not as much, you know, I'm not as big of a fan as a lot of people, so I try and watch the game, you know, if you have a running quarterback or a quarterback that's capable of running, it's much harder. I mean, you played a lot more football than me. But I always thought it was much harder to play defense than offense, right? In the offense, you block the guy in front of you, and if you do a good job, that's all you do. But the defensive guy, then it's supposed to, like, chase and do other stuff. So if you play 12 plays in a row, I think the defensive guy is generally more tired than the offensive guy, just in general. I mean, I don't know, you know, I never played pro or anything like that, but if you have a running quarterback that all of a sudden waits and waits and waits and somewhere in the fourth quarter runs three or four plays in a drive, you bury that defense. I don't care who the hell they are. All of a sudden, they're sucking air more than the offense because everybody in the field has to chase you where your offensive line doesn't run you down. I mean, some guys will go down and try and block, but basically it's not the same thing. So you see these...
It's just the way you have to play defense, too, because... You can't, you always have to account for the quarterback's ability to run. Whether it's the ability to run and get off a pass after getting flushed out of the back pocket, or whether it's the ability to take off and get 7 yards when he should have been sacked. Either way, you have to account for that in how you play. So you cannot, you have to hold just an extra step, and that. You know, that gives the blocker a little bit more of an advantage that you don't have against a guy who's more of the straight drop back quarterback who's not going to take.
But even so, I mean, one 20-yard run where everybody's chasing you, and then you hop back in the huddle and you come right out and run again. The defense isn't ready. I mean, Russell Wilson was spectacular at that when he was at Seattle. You know, all of a sudden he didn't run that much, but all of a sudden the fourth quarter he'd run twice, and it seemed like everything else he did worked. Right, I mean, you just open things up. I mean, there's a lot more to sport than kind of meets the eye. I mean, the more you get into it, the more you certainly. Hey, Kevin, the last few days we've all over the place with the talking. We had Dr. Blade on, and we were talking about the economy and people sort of getting laid off and the stuff going on with the Carl's talking about the Kroger people in Cincinnati. Is there any way to sum any of this up? It just seems, how do you stop it? Do you stop it? I mean, what is the motivation? You know, how do you when you try and protect people? Well, you know, try through Social Security and all that stuff, and it becomes a fee. All of a sudden, somebody goes, "Oh hell, I'm going to go to Timbuktu and hire some guy. We don't have to pay Social Security. Screw him." I mean, Do you need to even that out? Do you just let it go the other way and then let the people in Timbuktu decide that they want Social Security too 3 years from now, and now you got customers and it all works out, or not? How do you handle something? I mean, just on a general, what would be your instinct, and how do you handle something like that? I just wonder why if you know, again, I'm not a tariff guy. I mean, I'm absolutely against a lot of what, you know, the tariffs that Trump lobs out there, but I'm thinking if you're going to have a tariff, it should be on services as well, shouldn't it? I mean, maybe more so. I mean,
you would think so. So, look, this is a very, very long-term problem, and it's not just outsourcing the IT department for Kroger. That's an example, but that's not the biggest example. Now, as I think I told you, I have seen this in action when people outsource, like to India or someplace like that, just to get cheaper coders, cheaper network engineers. And there's a lot you can do remotely nowadays that you couldn't do in the past. Nevertheless, good luck managing it, because if you're going to try and manage that group, now you'll outsource the management, the day-to-day management, but you cannot just say, oh, it's in India, no problem, I don't have to pay any attention to it. It is a big management chore at the leadership level of any organization like Kroger. And I am telling you that they are very likely to be sorry they did this, because not only do you have to manage a workforce that's that far away, you're doing a lot of translation, even if it's all English to English. The way English is spoken there is different. So when you start talking about, writing up specifications for software development, when you talk about projects and trying to manage projects, it's really, really hard to do. And then you're also dealing with a different culture as a leader. And I have seen people fall on their faces doing this kind of outsourcing. So you may get some short-term cost benefit, but you may start to see that really, really hurt. So that's part one of it. Part two, though, and just in the broader sense, is we have been for decades just hollowing out our middle class by taking all kinds of jobs, whether they're manufacturing jobs or whether they are service types of jobs, and outsourcing them. You were talking the other day about who was the guest that made pots and pans?
He made the coating, the coatings for the pots and pans.
Coatings, yes. So he had to move his operation to be close to there, because we think we can outsource the parts that we want to outsource and keep the parts here, but it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way because the people who make the pots and pans and the people who make the coatings have to work together. And so if you're going to outsource making the pots and pans, then the coatings part of it needs to be nearby so that they can work together day after day after day. So we've had this, and J.D. Vance has talked about this a lot, and it is what is behind the onshoring, the reshoring initiatives of the current administration. When they talk about Hamiltonian economics, that's what they're talking about. And it really is an effort to bring it back, because I think Vance had it about a year ago, speaking to an innovation conference, had the right word for it. It was the conceit of offshoring, that we always thought, well, we could offshore all of the hourly work and keep the innovation home, and you don't keep the innovation home. And so now, when we told people, well, learn to code, well, no, that doesn't work either. So if you aren't making that, and this is laid out pretty clearly in the National Defense Strategy, that it's important to be a maker, and not just maker of key things like our pharmaceuticals and our weapons parts and all of those kinds of things, but to be a maker of everything that we do in this economy, and to do more manufacturing here, because if you don't, then you're not going to get the same kind of innovation. You will get some really cool inventions, so that's what I would refer to as product innovation, and you might get some stuff there, but as soon as you push the product innovation, the new product, over to another part of the world, it's going to take a little time, but then all of a sudden you have to worry about process innovation, which is how you make things better, stronger, faster, leaner, all of those things, and that's going to reside where things are made.
Well, I mean, without getting into anybody's opinion of any of these politicians, they all sound okay, Kevin, but from my end, it's you have to look at it one of two ways. You have to look at all this stuff. And I think, by the way, if I ever went through this and had the opportunity to present something, you'd be my right-hand man. I mean, whether you'd want to be or not, I don't know. But you look at the decision. Let's just take Kroger, because they're on the table. Let's look at the decision Kroger makes. Okay, well, how expensive is it here to hire a friggin' person? Okay, we've got hospitalizations up to, it's got to be $2,500 a month. Easy. You know, I'm going to say it might be more than that if you have a real high-end thing. Okay, you got that going for you. You got Social Security going for you. You got unemployment going for you. You have all kinds of, and I'm not against, you know, babies. Okay, I mean, obviously we were all one once, and if we weren't, we wouldn't be here. How much leave do you get? I mean, I know I'm being harsh here. That's why you have brothers and sisters and people to take care of. You plan for this kind of stuff. Do you really need the guy home for 8 weeks because the wife had a baby? I mean, these costs, I'm not adverse to any of this stuff. I want people to be healthy. But at some point, the costs we put on a place are absolutely dramatic. And I wonder if, you know, by the way, I agree with what J.D. Vance is talking about. If the factory's overseas, guess what? The innovation's going to be in the factory overseas, not here where nobody's doing anything. I mean, duh. But at some point, do you think these decisions are close enough to where if the hospitalization, and we could fix that area, and we wouldn't have those people stuffing everybody's pocket, Democrat, Republican, we have to maintain this incredible crap where people are paying, you know, $20 for a pill that costs $2. If the hospitalization per person was $1,200 a month and not close to $3,000, does that mean they might have stayed, Kevin? It might have. We don't address anything like that, and yet we just throw our hands up and wander off. I mean, we poo-poo this whole thing. But what are these cost differences? Are we too far to one end? Can we do something about it? I mean, obviously, it's cheaper. Well, why is it cheaper? I guarantee they're not paying hospitalization in India. I don't think. You know, I mean, I can't guarantee it, but I mean, maybe they got a house doctor in a place. But I mean, all these things are adding up, and nobody pays any attention to it. And I mean, I know, and again, it's going to sound like I'm anti-motherhood or something, but I'm sure not. I mean, my brother, when he, you know, Dan, when he was at GATX, this was long before he was trading, he was one of these guys that, you know, he was supposed to be on the road to the top, right? He had his MBA and his CPA. And Dan's a real bright guy. So they had him, and they put him in a different spot for 6 weeks in every part of the company. And he went out with some guy where they found railroad cars that were cripples on the side of the road somewhere and found them and located them. He did that for a while. And then he sold. He was in the skybox when they threw the snowball at the old field, Coors Field or whatever, in Mile High. But he said they had this lady. She gets hired, and they had a real generous, you know, baby policy. So she immediately gets pregnant. She's off for God knows how long. Comes back, like, takes her vacation. Then, like, has another kid. She was there 5 years. She was missing over 2.5 years. Well, Kevin, you can't do that. I mean, no. I mean, I guess if you're big enough and it's somebody else's money, you can tell somebody to do it. But at some point, it reaches a ridiculous stage, right? You know, and you even have the, I won't say the name of the little suburb here on the south side. Got this librarian who's there, you know, 25, 30 years, and she's allegedly terrific. So they say, okay, she's making way too much money. Now, in these small suburbs, when you kick somebody to their pension, the pension comes out of the state coffers, not yours, which is so asinine I can't even, you know, makes me livid to think of it. But so they sent her off to retirement. And now they're paying her, you know, 85% of her salary pension, right? They hire some new young lady who immediately gets pregnant. So she's off for God knows how long. You know, again, I'm not against motherhood. So what do you think they do? They hire the original lady back as a consultant while the lady's off. So now you're paying three salaries where you're paying one. I mean, somebody has to, if you don't address some of this bullshit, these decisions, you know, we can hue and cry about, you know, oh God, they should never have done this. But what caused them to do it? And is there any way we could bring some of that back a little? If we fix the medical part, and all of a sudden people's hospitalization was $1,200 a month instead of $2,700, I don't know that that tips the scales where they wouldn't have done it, but it might have. I mean, this all kind of ties together. Is what it, in my job on the show, I mean, my job is to tie all you guys together. And if you listen to everybody, it's all the same subject, Kevin. You can't just, you know, get on a pulpit somewhere and say, well, if we did this. No, you're right. It's been going on for a long time, and it's all around us. Can we fix any of it? I know I was on my soapbox here, but...
Undo it, but it's going to be step by step. And one of the problems that you have, and a lot of it was surrendered, and it wasn't only that we let a lot of industry get out of the country, but we also surrendered that it was inevitable. As Barack Obama was famous for saying, those jobs aren't coming back. Those manufacturing jobs aren't ever coming back. Well, you know, I think they actually are, because if you look at the you know, the most recent ISM, which keeps going up, the manufacturing index, you know, the summary comments, new orders growing, production growing, employment growing, supplier deliveries slowing a little bit, and raw materials inventories are growing, customers' inventories are too low, prices are increasing, imports are growing, exports are growing. So, all, you know, there's a lot going on there. But one of the ways that you do it is that we are in the midst of something now called the Department of War Acquisition Transformation Strategy. So this is part of the jumpstart for trying to get more manufacturing onshore, and that's to insist that the whether you call it Department of War, Department of Defense, I don't care about that, but their acquisition strategy, it requires that more of their materials be made in the United States. I think those are the kinds of things that you have to do if you want to bring back more production into the United States. Is you have to do, you have to jumpstart it that way, because you know, if you don't, and then the business, the related businesses have an incentive to come back, whether it's a tariff incentive or whether it's just a proximity incentive. They do have a need to come back where the production is happening.
Well, I think,
like
you have
we said earlier, the proximity for production is important.
Well, I think we need to do, like all of us probably, is, you know, kind of stop making these sort of grandiose, well, not you didn't do it, you know, Obama's 100% right on 50% of what he's talking about, which sounds really weird, but it's not really weird, because when you have to look, thanks to the Coach Leahy, when I took the class in labor economics, when you put something together and you're going to build something, whatever it is you're going to produce, you need something. You need power, you need people, you need land, you need maybe rail delivery, maybe you need a road near the place, maybe you need an exit, you know, the interstate. Whatever it is, there's all these things that contribute to efficiency. You know, can I buy the machines I need here? By the way, if a machine conks out, is there a place I can get the machines? Well, there's a, I won't say a million, but there's 100 variables in this mess. And labor is kind of just one of them. And the question is, how much of the labor, what skill set do you need? I mean, I don't think Obama thought it through. I don't think any president in my last four or five thought anything through, to be honest with you. But the when you say that, you're not going to get back here the you know, people working on sewing machines, or God help, sewing stuff on by hand, because other countries have, I'll use the word, an advantage in labor. There's more people in Vietnam that kind of a job is a step up than people here. Okay, nobody wants to do that here because they don't have to. I mean, maybe there's some places where they do, but unless it's a really, you know, unless it's a really high-end factory with the best machines and all the other stuff, maybe. But there's nothing wrong with that, Kevin. I mean, it's just the way the world is. But now here, you might have, well, hell, the power's cheaper here. We got transportation. They don't. By the way, we got a railroad right behind the damn place, which is a huge advantage. And, oh, by the way, we can raise capital. We may have all these different advantages. It doesn't mean that every single industry... And I think what this administration is sort of trying to do is, at least the ones that we have an advantage in, like why the hell did they leave kind of thing, to try and get those guys back. Because you got to get the person back where the decision, was kind of a, I'll use the term, a toss-up, where they did it and they weren't really sure they had to. That's the company that I think, if, wait a minute, what if all your people, if the hospitalization is $700 less a month, they might say, we never would have left, and by the way, we're coming back. Or it could be what J.D. Vance is talking about. It could be, you know, do you get a step up with the government maybe leaning towards places that are here? Do I think that would help? Hell yeah. So I'm not arguing with the guy. I'm saying there's a lot of things involved here, and if we just, for a second, get somebody who has a couple of brains on each side of the aisle together and say, all right, where's our six-step plan here? What are we doing? I think it really would work. We actually could get...
There are probably more pieces than we give credit for, and they do seem to go well together. And as Lou is saying, Trump is not good at communicating this at all. Vance is great at it, you know, and he understands it, but he doesn't get nearly the play that Trump does. So as an example, if you go back to May of 2025, Trump created a pilot program that was funding companies or helping fund companies who could build nuclear reactors that would get up and running. And four companies in a year, and this was a 1 year, it was aimed at July 4th, 2026. And four companies met the deadline and had prototype nuclear reactors up and running. And these were, you know, these were some of the small types of, you know, nuclear reactors that we have. And so, you know, all of them are expecting to be online in the next 2 years completely, but they had their prototypes up and running. You know, I think that's important because cheap power and available power is important to what we do.
Well,
there's a lot of initiatives going on, and they don't get a lot of play, and we just sort of assume it's all a bunch of random events, and they're not.
Here's the issue I have with this particular group, and I have a lot of issues with them. They don't seem to have the idea that I do, that you try and level the... I have much more respect, shall we say, to every man. This particular group, and maybe it's just the president himself, I won't accuse J.D. Vance of this. If his name's not on it, he doesn't want it. I mean, it seems to me. So, I mean, it's always going to be somebody from overseas. I have incredible confidence in our system here, with people being able to raise money, stock, or bonds or something, that if we... somehow or another, we have to get, and I really believe this, we've got to get this medical piece down from 22% of the economy to like 15. I think that helps. Now, does it help every single place? But I mean, some of these types of the nuclear stuff should be. Maybe it's a little too big, Kevin. I might have to roll with you on this one. They need a little boost from government. I'm going to say that, and. You know, especially if there's some of the new styles that Carl's talking about, I don't know that they could go out and get the financing for that themselves without a little boost from government. So, I'm going to roll with JD on this one. The individual people couldn't have created the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. Individual people couldn't have built Hoover Dam. So, I'm willing to roll with you on this one. But I think a lot of all the other stuff, though, by and large, doesn't have to be somebody from overseas putting money here. I mean, somebody from this that somehow somebody's attached to or something like that. We need to have more confidence in the system. But I'll roll with you on the nuclear stuff, because I get a feeling that the initial development probably needs some sort of governmental help. I do believe that. And especially if you're rolling down the line of new technologies, you know, that's a long way for somebody to go out and raise that money as a startup. So, yeah, I'm not totally against you on this one. Against you?
Just saying. Yeah, and as far as the healthcare stuff, the Trump administration has tried to address some of it, but I think it's mostly trimming around the edges, and it's not really anything profound at this point. Trump has talked about, instead of filtering everything through insurance companies or insurance exchanges, trying to put more healthcare money into the pockets of individual people, but I don't see a lot of progress. I don't see a lot of meat on that bone. So everything else, whether it's, you know, creating some, drug exchanges or, revamping some of the stuff that Kennedy's doing on the that's to me is all trimming around the edges. It needs to be done, but it's not anything that's going to profoundly affect.
Well, they're not going to go after. Nobody addresses the idea that chemotherapy is $50,000 here and it's $5,000 somewhere else. Nobody's willing to go down that road because these drug companies are paying these guys off since day one, and there's a group of people who were absolutely convinced that if we just had term limits, that wouldn't happen. That's total bullshit. All it means is these guys will start paying guys when they're representatives from Illinois or Ohio or Michigan. They're going to start paying them sooner. You got to break the...
Well, I think they already are.
Yeah.
And they own media. I mean, just watch any news channel and how many pharmaceutical ads do you see per hour. It's a remarkable number. And all of those news organizations would have a really, really hard time making, turning a profit or even being economically viable without all of that advertising. So we aren't going to get any media support because media's got an interest of their own, and that's, that's completely different.
Well, the episode with
in other words, we need to rally a lot of people behind any initiative that's gonna shift anything in terms of healthcare, and we ain't gonna get that.
No, but it's, I mean, look at the Viagra situation. I'll say that not as an old guy. They somehow, and this is a great example because it's not a drug that is a lifesaver. Well, I guess to some people maybe it is. Somehow they weaseled, and I'll use that term purposely, they weaseled their patent up from 17 to 19. Kevin, how the bleep do you do that? I don't know, but they did somehow. So they and, who are the other guys? Levitra was never a big commercial, but Cialis. I remember those commercials because the lady had the best set of luggage I've ever seen. They were how much money to the NFL and CNBC? Because CNBC, their audience is older. They were all over. How much was it? Was it $40 million? Did the NFL? It was some massive number. In the day they came off patent, they dropped all the ads. I think they were like, wait, Andrew, try and look that up. Could you? How much?
Yeah, they were huge. Now it's the generics are getting a lot of ad time, but I don't know that they're getting the prime time type of exposure that some of the others are. You see ads for generic, and we'll save you money on whatever the term is for generic Viagra and generic Cialis now. But I see those ads on TV all the time. I can't swear. I'd have to pay attention to see if I see them on ball games and such, because I don't think they have the same big dollar spending initiative for advertising that the original makers had before patents expired.
You think there might be a little more scratch to pay for commercials when it's $50 a pill instead of $5?
Oh yeah, I am absolutely certain of it. So yeah, it totally makes sense. I just don't pay much attention to the ads other than to notice that they exist. So maybe I'll have to pay attention to where I see them, what shows have them. It might, it might be the kind of stuff where it shows up in the middle of the night, for all I know.
Well, yeah, that stuff's real cheap. But the amount of most of them now are for skin diseases. If you take like the top 10, they're for diseases you don't even know existed, unless you had one, I guess.
Oh God, that I have a running list of made up names for pharmaceuticals and. You can run down to it. What's a Rexulti, an Entyvio, yeah, a Rinvoq, a Jardiance, a Skyrizi, a Keytruda? I don't even know what these things do. But damn, there's a lot of names, and they're just totally invented for each new drug.
Well, I think that these are drugs. By the way, speaking of Viagra, do we have Mr. Flanagan?
Yes, you do.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, John.
Sorry about that intro, John.
It's okay. I've just been enjoying you guys for the last hour. So.
But, I think all these drugs might have something in, hopefully, in common. There's stuff you have to take for the rest of your life. Those are. Does anybody really want a cure? You know what's supposed to be, and I don't know. Maybe you guys can tell me this.
Well, what did we learn through all of the COVID nonsense? The answer is no. We don't want anything that treats it. Really, we just want to sell vaccines.
Well, the one that was, this goes back a ways, and I have not heard it being used since, and I don't know what happened to it, but supposedly, for those that can think back 15 years, because my buddy Dr. J was was prematurely bald, and he always was all over this stuff, so I knew everything about this stuff, because Janet was doing every kind of thing he could, but none of it worked, but he looks fine, I mean, whatever. But the Rogaine was going to be, originally it was a blood pressure medication, and people noticed that people taking it for blood pressure, which I don't know if anybody takes anymore for blood pressure, started to grow their hair back to a certain extent. And then they said, okay, you can use this topically, meaning you can rub it on your dome and your hair would grow back. I don't know if it ever really worked for everybody, but the idea was this was going to be like $50 a month for the rest of your life. the way better than a cure for cancer, right? imagine that if somebody started to go bald when they were like 28 and lived to 100, $50 a month for 72 years. That's the drug you want.
Yeah, I would guess so. Now you can get transplants, so you don't have to worry about it.
Well, you always could do that, but that, yeah. Here's a nasty story.
Just to follow up a little bit, because John was on Monday with Dr. Mark, and you were talking about young people as well, and young people checking out of the workforce and how how they're going to have to find their way back. My diagnosis of it anyway, it's just my personal diagnosis, and it may or may not have enough weight, but it feels true to me, is that we spent a lot of time in recent years pushing college really, really hard, pushing college degrees. Certainly as an educator, I'm not going to dismiss the value of college education, because I think there's a lot of value. I think there's also a lot of value in certain types of college education versus others. But we put a lot of people through college. Many of them accumulated debt, and this was all with the promise of success in your lives. And now they get out of college, and they find out that the kinds of jobs that they thought they were going to get don't exist. And who the hell wants to be take your college education and work at the coffee shop? I think working at the coffee shop is a really sweet job, and it's a good place to start out, but is that really, did I go to college for this? Did I go to college to work at a grocery store? Did I, none of those. And I think that's the disillusionment that you're seeing with people, is that the promise of why they should go to college and what they should get out of it, and then the actual event of it, has just tended to discourage a whole hell of a lot of people. And then you throw on top of it with young men that during their college experience, how many times did they hear the term toxic masculinity? That's a really strong put down of young men. I think, yes, we have a very disaffected group of young people in the world. And that's part of why they're kind of checked out at this point.
When you say, let me lob this to both of you, and then you can both come at me big time. Unfortunately, I always go to cost. Now, when you say we, Kevin, I'll say, who's we? You got a mouse in your pocket? Every class you've taught at that place, at the price that you charge people, I wouldn't want to say that no matter what, if you teach somebody something in supply chain, and the guy or girl goes on to be a dentist assistant, you're going to say at the price that they paid and the knowledge you gave them, it's accretive. and nobody went to Notre Dame or any place when we went, because Notre Dame was $3,000 a year and University of Illinois was a fabulous place with probably $1,500. Nobody who spent 4 years away learning how to deal with people at $3,000 a year learning something could say that they wasted their time. I don't think. You learn something. I mean, when I went, my grandmother told me, go learn something. She didn't care what... She never said, come out an engineer and go dig ditches like in the Lou Gehrig story, and if you don't make $40,000 a year your first year, you're a failure. There was no debt. There was nothing like that. We have elevated whoever the hell the we is. It's not any of the three of us. Certainly not you, because you're doing the same thing people did for us. So, you know, I wouldn't... This is not an admonishment. Don't include yourself in that we. You're not charging somebody $80,000 a year. You're doing the stuff that people did for us. And every one of them, I think, was worthwhile. Do you ever say, when you're done with a class, I taught these people supply chain management, but if the guy works in a Starbucks, I totally wasted his time? I don't think you did, because now the guy knows how to do supply for Starbucks, for God's sake. So, I mean, at that price, there's I don't think there's ever any bad education. The promise is, oh, yeah, run up a $1 million bill, and, oh, by the way, you're going to make so much more money because you were here, that bill's going to be nothing. Well, that's the thing that's screwed up, I think.
And that's a result of just pumping so much money into college. You know, it's just like, you know, what happens when you pump money into the economy? Prices go up. Happens when you pump money into the colleges? Prices go up, and stuff gets spent. As far as I'm concerned, that you find, you know, you find some real, you know, just lavish stuff that didn't exist before. And, you know, you've talked about, you know, the amount of overhead that goes into, for instance, the University of California system or something like that. I know you've used that example in the past. I really think we've done everything we could to drive up the cost under the guise of availability, of making college available. And, there's just so much that we've done wrong along the way, and we're starting to see a price. But in the meantime, a lot of people have fallen by the wayside as sort of victims of unfulfilled promise.
If somehow or another the three of us, you know, get the word from the future, okay, on where the market's going, which I've never gotten yet, but if we did, and all of a sudden we pointed up some money, let's say the three of us became the three goofballs in a partnership, and we made $20 billion. What number would we have to give? And I'll use our own lovable assholes at Notre Dame. What would we have to give those people? What kind of check would we have to write to say the tuition's going to be $20,000 for the next 5 years? They wouldn't even want to talk to us. It could be $5 billion. Or they'd find some way to renege on it. There's no amount of money that you can give these people now to where they're going to go back to where we think education ought to be. How do you stop that?
You know, one thing that I've been thinking about in my advanced age, looking back on my life, is that kind of the collapse of your job prospects, you know, coming out of college, was already kind of predicted in the collapse of job prospects for people in postgraduate programs, just as I was kind of dipping my feet in the water about them. And, you know, I went back to college after the 12 years after you and I got out of Notre Dame, Tom, and started an English, you know, master's PhD program at Loyola. And the mantra that everybody in that department was telling the students in 1986 was, you are perfectly poised. You're coming at just the right time, because there's going to be a complete evacuation of the old guard in academia, and all these professors who have been sitting around for the last 30 or 40 years are going to have to hang it up. It's like thinking about it in terms of like the real estate market or something, that there'd be a huge turnover, and we could have our pick of jobs, you know, as soon as we got our degrees. And, you know, people bought it. And, you know, kept paying their tuition every year and doing the grunt work of being a graduate assistant and everything else. And it never happened. And it wasn't just in English that it didn't happen. It didn't happen in history or any of the humanities. And, of course, that the prospects now for people in graduate programs, assuming that there are even the graduate programs that you want in the schools you can afford to attend, that they even exist anymore, is long gone. But that's been replicated in the undergraduate experience now, which I didn't foresee, so that the prospects of going from 4 years in maybe an okay degree, you know, as few as those may be today, where you actually do have a chance of finding an employer who needs what you can do when you graduate, the chances of getting a job that you compete for and, you know, not be trumped by somebody who doesn't have anything, you know, more than you do, but for whatever reason you didn't fit the bill. I just think that kind of recruiting is just as tough now as it's turned out to be for people higher up in academia, which is, you know, now it's just like a desert. I mean, I don't think there's people are dropping humanities PhD programs left and right because there's no reason for them anymore.
I think there is that, absolutely a reason. I just think.
But I mean, a reason in that they can't attract people with any kind of a half-hearted promise that you'll ever work in this program. Tom, Kevin, of all the people I knew in the program at Loyola, master's and PhD, I think I know one other person. This is out of like 70, 75 people who actually got a job in teaching. And didn't want to have an adjunct routine for the rest of their lives. They pulled back. They changed their focus. They became lawyers. They became editors. They worked for publishers. They did, you know, education development curriculum stuff, you know, kind of desk job stuff behind the scenes. But their real dream was to teach, and they never got a crack at it.
Well, John, what do you suppose, or Kevin, when we went to I'm going to say one of the most things I'm most proud of is going to University of Chicago and listening to guys like Stigler and Friedman and people that were Nobel Prize winners, for God's sake. But I paid my entire 2 years is less than one class now. Okay, so I have no idea, but let's forget about the University of Chicago. What about, I mean, who's your best professor at Notre Dame? I like Donello and some of the guys in the economics department. I'm going to guess, what do you think Croteau made, Kevin? And he was a full professor. $40,000?
Oh, don't know.
But it was somewhere in there, wouldn't you think? $35,000, $40,000, I bet.
And they were the high flyers.
And they were the high flyers. And now, okay, our tuition was $3,000 or $3,500. Well, the guy who's teaching in the same class that Croteau taught us, the tuition is 25 times higher. 22 to 25. Do you think that dude is now making $1 million? Where's the money going? I mean, not to mention all the people that have donated money in the last 40 years or 50 years. What are we doing here?
Tom, I think that's a big part of it is, like I said, a lot of overhead stuff is happening because money's got to go somewhere. When we flood the system with money, it's going to land somewhere. So that's part of it. Just a couple of add-ons to what John said. One is I will offer the idea that the unfulfilled promise is in part ties back to what we said earlier, that when you went to college, it was to prepare you not just to get a job, but to get, you know, to get at least be on a fast track to a leadership role. But when you outsource so much of what you do and send it overseas, there ain't a whole lot of leadership roles that remain behind, because the leadership, you know, the management roles, the operations management roles, go where the jobs are. So you have that, you have to deal with that issue. So I think that's, you know, that's a piece of it. Let me see. I had a second one that sort of slipped my mind at this
point. Kevin, when we were young, would we say too many chiefs, not enough Indians?
Well, yeah, but it isn't necessarily that. It's that somebody has to manage. Somebody has to be, you know, team leaders. And, you know, I see a lot of people who do come back to school because they're working in manufacturing, but maybe working on a production line and saying, you know what, I don't want to be doing this forever. It's hard work. It's good. You know, good honest work, but it's physical. And, you know, I felt the same way about, you know, working for a construction job when I was in college, working a summertime construction job. Wasn't what I wanted to do forever. And so you know, the promise was to get into something that got you on a different track. And I see people who will come back to school now, and they want to get on a different track so that they can either be in a leadership role. You can either be a manager, or start as a supervisor, then progress to manager, maybe plant manager or whatever. Or to move into an office job, like to get into purchasing, procurement, the general field of procurement, supply chain management, logistics, all of those kinds of things. So, you know, that's sort of the promise, but that's the promise that has been largely unfulfilled because there aren't enough of those jobs to go around.
Kevin, what is, and John too, and the we've had this debate, got back and forth, and actually we had the guy who might have been the most articulate at it was the late Bill Moriarty, talked about people's attitude on the South Side towards manufacturing and construction jobs. And it, in his mind, you know, and I can say this because he's not around to debate me, he thought it was more, in almost like 80%, 20%, that it was more, not that people necessarily minded working construction, because some people really like it. I mean, I actually kind of liked it. In your mind was, as soon as this job was over, I might have to wait 5 months for somebody to do something else. Or, if this factory ever goes, where the hell am I going to take my welding equipment? He said he thought it was way more the insecurity in those jobs, which if you're on the South Side of Chicago, is foremost in your mind, because everybody knew somebody that plant just left or something. Or, oh, by the way, we're putting another lane in the tri-state, and we might do it again 20 years from now, kind of thing. How much of it is the insecurity versus those jobs versus
on the tri-state? But keep going.
Yeah, you're right about the tri-state. But I mean, by and large, we've had times in our lifetime in Chicago. I mean, John's place, it wasn't the Chicago Title and Trust the only building built downtown for like a decade, and all of a sudden there's 10 of them, and then there's another decade. I mean, I think those jobs were more beat up because of the insecurity than the actual job itself. One man's opinion.
Right. No, I think you're right. I think that factors into everything that we've discussed about, you know, offshoring jobs, that we've done this to chase lower labor cost. But in the process, we as a country have done more damage than good. Larissa talks about K-shaped economy all the time. That's exactly what the K-shaped economy is about, is we've hollowed out the middle class jobs.
But we also, somewhere along the line, and this we got to go to break here in a few minutes, but maybe a little bit we'll talk about because I want to get back into some of these stocks being incredibly overvalued, in my opinion. But
I'm going to drop off when we go to break. And
all right. Then say something before you go regarding.
Don't take anything from them.
No, where does. Eric wants to come back on now that he's feeling better, so we'll have him back on. When he used to talk about this management class that has sort of taken over industry, that really isn't beholden to the owners, the shareholders. But in his opinion, the whole corporate board structure of who's running what is totally wrecked. I mean, news barker tortilla leaders, they don't pay any attention to their board. The shareholders don't have any power, and yet they feel that they need these massive amounts of money. Because it'd be one thing if the chairman of Merck actually developed a drug in his younger days, but now he's in charge of other people doing stuff, and he thinks he should make 10 times more money than they do. I mean, way too long of a story, but how much do you think that is a problem here, too, that they don't mind moving people all over the damn place? Their idea, they got a world company. They don't have a U.S. company. How much does that filter in before you go, Kevin? We'll talk more about that Friday, but I think that's a big part of it. I don't think these people give a shit about the U.S.,
I think that's true. They're just going to do what the incentives, what gets rewarded, and that's what they're going to do.
You and I wouldn't do that. We like the place. We're not Harold Janine. The governments are just people of pawns in the way. That you're really the master of the universe. We don't think that way.
And I would go back through our educational system and say, how are we doing at developing an ethical core amongst young people as they come through the education system? And the answer, I think, is not very well.
How can you have an ethical core when you see people at the top of government for forever, and this is getting worse and worse, you can't look at a Paul Simon anymore or a Dan Inouye. Or the weird part about the this whole thing regarding Fauci, I had a big discussion last week, and I might want to get into that. How that manages to get political, I have no idea. If the guy screwed up, he was there through five different presidents of every ilk. So if the guy's made decisions that were influenced by medical people, I think it needs to be ferreted out. I don't care how this became a Democrat versus Republican thing. I have no idea. I mean, I guess I do have an idea, but it startles me. But, you know, kind of where I'm going with is I had a group, there was maybe eight people sitting around BSing, of course, and somebody starts talking about Fauci, and I said, well, I think once in a while, and I think you guys might actually agree with me on this one, you need to pick a topic, and you have to run it to ground and find out just who the knaves are behind it. Now, whether you pick Fauci or whether you pick Epstein and not the girl part, but you pick the part that Wayne and Andrew are always talking about, who are these money launderers? How do they manage to get money from place to place when nobody's supposed to? You know, you can run that, pick something and run it to ground. Each and every person said, I don't trust anybody in government to do that investigation. There's no Sam Irwin. There's no Dan Inouye. That, to me, is a worse statement than the crime in the first place. No, there's not. I said, you got to believe. Somewhere in the Senate, somewhere in the House, if you put all those idiots in a room and knock their head together and say, is there one person here we can count on to be straight? And they go, no. That's pretty friggin' awful.
You know what makes it worse? And then I'll leave you guys alone. What I think makes it worse is we don't trust anybody in media. Media is actually, might be lower than in terms of trust level, might be lower than government. And so now you're in a situation where the people who should be reporting on it don't have any faith, don't have any trust either.
Okay, but I'm going to lob one at you. I know you got to go. We'll talk more about this.
Who could expose it? Who could cause? Who could educate?
But when you say media, who's media? No, when I ask a simple question like on the finance area, I listen to CNBC all day, and we listen to Fox, and we don't get Bloomberg that much. But the thing that's not a news show. That's designed to have guests on from these companies and from government, and to basically blow them. That, you know, they're there. If you're not going to get the chairman of General Motors on right after the earnings and ask our tough questions and ever come back, it ain't happening. So somehow or another, we've been, I'll use the term, brainwashed into think that CNBC all day is the same as Walter Cronkite at 5 o'clock at night. No, they're not, and they're not designed at all to be like that. Yet the only thing news on that station is the stuff running across on the bottom telling you where the market is. I mean, although they'll tell you what's happening, if they'll tell you what the earnings are and the money supply, that part. But by and large, to me, that's not news. That's not Walter Cronkite actually telling you what
they're going to slant. They're going to slant that stuff too.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's not like, when the networks gave out an hour a day, they competed. Walter Cronkite and who guys were on 7 and on 5, but they didn't. They actually said we're going to give to 90% of the time it was just straight news, I think. But now it's not news. It's a combination of commentary. They know who their suppliers are. They know who their advertisers are. You're right, Kevin. But how do you break through that? I mean, on my IB feed here, they have CNBC in there, and evidently, or whoever, I don't know, whoever the left wing group is. And I read the right wing stuff, and I'm sitting there going, God, this is a bunch of crap. Now these guys, every headline doesn't match what's in the article. Every headline is designed on the left versus the right. Does anybody's headline ever match the facts that are in the thing, or are there any facts? All they're doing is being divisive to everybody, for God's sake. But evidently that sells. I mean, it must, because they're not that dumb.
Well, so now you have to work and you have to subscribe to sources that are good. And, you know, I have a few. I highly recommend, I subscribe to Cheryl Atkinson because I think she's honest and objective. I subscribe to Catherine Herridge because I think she's a really, really good reporter. And there's a few others out there. where I have some subscription services too. But these are people who not only will report objectively, but then when they are reporting as, okay, here's my opinion, they're very clear about here's my opinion. They're not dressing up opinion as news.
Well, okay, we got to go to break here, but it's also, they're not, I love them. By the way, she was my best guest. She was on a couple times. I wish I could get her back. Maybe, who knows, we might try. The fact that she's not working for the Tribune or CBS or something is appalling to me, because she's that good. The fact that John Cass left the Tribune is appalling to me. He should be front and center in the Tribune. If Mike Rutko was alive, nobody'd hire him, would they? That's crazy. That's what the news is supposed to be, for God's sake. I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe who owns them or whatever, but anyway, Kevin, you got to go. We got to go to break. We'll solve all the problems of the world on Friday, and as we always do. S&P futures up 28, NASDAQ futures up 256. We come back, Mr. Flanagan's going to tell us how he's going to trade this market. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax-deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right
here, right now. Low North-based Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tamara Andrew on the board. S&P futures up 30, NASDAQ futures up 260. We're going to be real quick here because we got the CPI just came out. And once you're traveling weather sports, I'm going to kick up the CPI because we're just going to be jumping around here. They caught 1.1% in the month. I'm going to call BS on that, but we'll get that up here. Why don't you do traffic, weather, sports, and then John and I will go through these numbers.
All right, sounds good. Keeping it simple here, the Cubs won over the Nationals 8-6. Sox lost to the Sox lost to the Reds 4-5, and the Diamondbacks lost to the Rockies 2-3. Over Chicago weather, it's thankfully looking a little calmer than yesterday, although kind of similar in the sky. We're currently at 72 degrees. We have a high of 80. We will have some thunderstorms today, but they're going to be hopefully nowhere near as bad as yesterday.
It was awful.
Yeah, it was not a good one, but yeah, no warnings today, just pretty average storms. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 87 degrees. They're going to have a high of 104, and they actually do have some thunderstorm warnings. It's going to be into this late afternoon, into the night. Warnings of high winds and lightning warnings and even a flood warning, so I don't always see that over there. Finally, for Chicago traffic, the inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 21 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 35. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 29. The Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 17 minutes. And the Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 25 minutes. Back to you, Chief.
I'm trying to find the... here we go. Table 1, Consumer Price Index. John, just, there's no inflation. Don't worry about it. Mr. Floyd?
Oh, good.
No inflation.
Thank God.
You're good to go on that. when are we going to stop lying to people? Ever?
Well, there'd be so many lies we'd have to revoke. I don't know where to start.
Yeah, I mean, it's really. I'm thinking no, but we've got. Let's see. I'd like to look at the adjusted, or we've got unadjusted June to July. Actually, it is July 2020. Last year to this year is 3.4. They actually have unadjusted 0%, right? I don't buy that. I haven't for a long time. And the two, let me see where we've got the medical stuff. Let's see what was down in the month. Medical care commodities were down. Let's see, what else we've got? Well, all items less food and energy was up 0.2. Energy services, gasoline, I got down 2.9. So we've got the gas and motor fuel, but those are back up the last 2 weeks, right? So that'll be like a one month deal. And here's another one. Fuel oil is up 1%, and the adjusted is down 1.7. How do you do that? You know, so gasoline, they've got 2.1 is the real number, and now the adjusted number is down 2.9. Well, in the last 2 weeks, it's flying all right back up again, right? Or what am I missing? The owner's equivalent rent year over year is 3.2. Anybody who thinks that rents are only up 3% in the last year, really? Medical care services over the last year is 2.7% on the upside. I don't know about that. Do you? What do you think?
No.
So, you know, if we tell people they're not going up, they're really not going up, or what? Well, how does this all come together, Jan? We got money supply blowing up. We've got people, you know, doing stuff with the Japanese yen. And oh, by the way, I'm going to look at that to see what that's doing today, because we always talk about that. When do the people who seem to be playing all these games, when do the games end, or do they?
It's impossible for me to determine a trend, which I think is the purpose of having data and the way it's, you know, arranged in spreadsheet form. You should be able to identify trends of some kind and then try to fit one trend against another and make a larger speculation about what all these trends point to. And I can't do it. To me, I feel like every time I think I see some kind of pattern, I find too many outliers to that pattern. Well, there goes my theory about whether this is a better or worse profile than a month ago. And I'm having the same trouble just eyeballing this thing. So,
well, I mean, it comes down to the key number here, the key ingredient of all this, and it really ties into the, you know, pushing people offshore and all the other stuff that Kevin and I talked about earlier. It comes down to, What does it take to run a business? How can you do it? I mean, whether or not, you know, J.D. Vance, who I think probably is walking the right way here, you know, you want to listen to his story about what it is, or what does it come down to? You've got to dig down to the individual person and say, what does it cost for you to do business here? And by the way, what are your prices? Where are your prices? There was a delicatessen that just left Clybourne yesterday. It was a Jewish delicatessen, and they were there for a while, and they were somewhere for like years, but they did open up. The guy goes, I just can't do it. The rent's too high, the electric's too high. I mean, I can't sell enough corned beef sandwiches to make up for it. I mean, what actually is, you know, if somebody wants to do that, what's the lease? What does it cost for the permits? How long do you got to wait for the permits? You know, what does it cost for the electric guy to make sure that he gets inspected properly? I mean, what do you got to pay this guy? Does anybody actually give a crap to go through the numbers and say, you can't sell that many omelets? I mean, there aren't enough omelets in the world for that. I mean, it's, well, where are we in the sense of somebody being able to open up a business and do something in a way where you can actually have some attempt at making some money at it? It's not just about you being greedy. It's about, can you get a loan for it? If you go to the bank and say,
can you survive? Can you pay people?
Well, if you go to my favorite bank, Lakeside, if you go to Lakeside and say, gee, I'm opening up a deli, will you make any money? Nah, it looks like a loser to me. Oh, but by the way, to lend me some money, they're going to look at you like you got five heads, right? I mean, so what are these real numbers? If we don't come to grips with the real number, you know, we're never going to get anywhere. It's like, you know, in the TV show MASH, you know, you come back on the bus, you know, with the wounded, and at some point you got to say, "Gee, Kevin O'Neill's got a broken leg." If you don't identify that's the problem, you keep giving them pain pillers to the cows come home. But guess what? At some point, you got to identify the issue, don't you?
Well, just looking at this digest, which is probably AI written. This is the sort of thing AI could do. But food away from home index rose 3.4% over the last year. The index for full-service meals rose 3.4%, and the index for limited-service meals rose 3.3% over the 12 months ending in July. I don't know about Utah, but I think that's half of what I've seen. I think it's close to 6%.
I don't think it's even half. I think it's probably a third. I mean, if you found a place where everything's not up 10%, then what's the dollar menu at McDonald's now? A buck and a half?
Yeah, I mean, are they talking about menu price here? I'm wondering if this has been jiggered in some way where this has nothing to do with what the consumers pay, but what the producers are having to pay to produce these things, which is a completely different number.
Hey, food away from home up 3.4%. Well, I challenge you on that.
Yeah.
What about booze away from home?
Oh, I just saw that here.
No, they
immediately went to that.
Well, I just see on mine, I got non-alcoholic beverages and beverage materials is up 4.1%.
Yeah.
There might be a couple of restaurants where, the drink isn't up 10%, but I can't name one, can you?
No, any place selling a glass of wine has gone up more than 10%.
Well, my buddy Billy, who actually was on the show when we first started, but he's retired, he was talking about history. His dad owned Orlando's, which was in the building. What's the name of the building just west of the insurance exchange? It was the insurance something was the building. And it was the one that Lizard Boy, what the hell is his name, bought the place and totally ran it down. Well, anyway.
The one on the other side of Wells from you?
Yeah, yeah.
I can find it.
But anyway, the building got down to like 25% accuracy, so his dad was ready to retire anyway. Closed the place, Orlando's, and then Billy went to work across the street at the Excelsior, and then he ended up, and then he went over to Ceres, because they're all owned by Greek people, and Billy, they were in the group, shall we say, he would tell me that they used to have every night, used to walk in, and the drinks were half of what they are now, or if that, every night they had hors d'oeuvres, they just dropped stuff on the table. Now you don't even get popcorn. And he tells me that they used to make more dough when the lunches were $4.50 than they do now when they're $16. He goes, there's no comparison in the profit ratio in terms of the leases and the electric bill and all the other stuff. Because even though the prices are incredible, it's hard to make money. They say we made way more money at $4 an omelet than we do at 12. Not even close. How scary is that?
Very scary.
I mean, it has nothing to do with people, with how much it is that you think that you're, hey, it costs you, 80 cents for that omelet and you're charging me, 12. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with how long is your behind in that chair, how many behinds can they get through the place, and what's the overhead, right?
Yep.
I mean, it's a totally different calculation.
But if you think about, what dining out to not a high-flying moneymaker today is like, when you factor in all of the things that are, making that meal out possible, forget the meal just for a minute, but you got to figure on what it's going to cost you to park at that place. And if you use the city meters, it's going to be maximum because it'll be in a high-density neighborhood
with
a charge of totally inflated amount. If you have to have a babysitter, all the other stuff you have to juggle in your life to get the time slot to do that dining out experience. I just think that it doesn't, if it were, less than it has been, if there were a drop in the price of the food or whatever else, it wouldn't stimulate any more activity on the average person's part because the whole thing is just, the experience is becoming too expensive.
Well, not
just for food and drink.
I mean, Jen, you have a certain amount of hubris in the sense that you like everybody when they talk or write to at least be able to talk or write properly because that's what you taught forever, right? And I feel the same way about numbers. And I hear these politicians, and I know Kevin loves to listen to J.D. Vance, and I'm not accusing him of being an idiot at all. I don't think he is, by the way. But I listen to these people, and they don't seem, maybe they think it's their audience that they can't ever talk about any detail. But I listened to these guys. I listened to Bernie Sanders the other day in Face the Nation. Does Bernie even own a calculator? I mean,
would he know how to use it?
Wouldn't I mean, like everything this stuff sounds great. In a minute, you ask one or two questions. How the hell is that going to? You need to have some idea of somewhat the detail of what you're trying to accomplish, and who it's going to affect. Because everything you do affects somebody, right? I mean, you can't.
Yep.
You can't just say, well, we're going to raise this tax, or you can't, because we have blithering, I'll say blithering idiots, they're blithering idiots in the area that I know well. Okay, so if you have a mayor, for instance, who wants to sell the parking meters, you go, okay, well, the parking meter is going to go from $4 to park in front of somebody's place to say 11 or something, you know, okay, well, that's a number. Now, it's not just only I'm going to say the moron lets it land there. Okay, so what does that mean exactly? Well, we're not going to stop people paying at parking meters at 6 o'clock like you used to. We're going to go to 10. All right, so then you need to, if you have any sort of economic or cost accounting knowledge, you got to go, okay, what's that going to do to Club Lago? Now, you should go in. You've got a place or two. You should walk in and maybe interview 5 people at the bar at 6 o'clock. Okay, where did you come from? Well, I work down the block. Okay, well, you're not going to affect him or her, right? Probably. Now, you might run into somebody, say, like me. Well, I work downtown and I like the place. Did you drive here? Well, yeah, I'm on the way home. Well, okay, how much did you pay to park? Well, now it's $11. So what are you here for? I'm saying goodbye to my friends. I'm never coming back. I mean, there's some story here that whatever you do, you impact somebody else. Now, if you're going to get an income tax, which the city doesn't have, or you're going to charge the Club Lago or the Tripoli Tap or somebody, now you get 10 less people a night because nobody wants to pay the parking, what does that do to impact them? And what does that do to the fact that maybe if they're close to being in business or out of business, they go out of business. Now, all of a sudden, okay, you had a property tax there of $80,000 a year that you're not getting. I mean, you got to think this stuff through, at least to some extent. And I don't see anybody at any level of government doing this, do you?
No. And even the most basic thing, you know, can you park your car and, you know, hope that it won't be ransacked or rifled or stolen while you're, you know, or that you won't be robbed sitting in the restaurant? This has happened. You know?
Yeah.
I think all of this is, you know, people can find so many reasons not to bother with this, and it isn't because they wouldn't enjoy it. If they did, maybe they would, but the chance of having it spoiled or of being shocked by what the menu looks like compared to what it looked like 6 months ago discourages you from even bothering the experience. And, you know, I just think that you're pummeled by reasons not to go out and spend money. And it isn't just because you don't have the money. It's because it's whatever you're going to spend is going to be more than you expected or more than it was worth. And you kind of talk yourself into this culture of, you know, withdrawing. And this is what's fatal to any kind of growth model or any kind of business expansion or, you know, the chances of opening a restaurant, have anybody patronize it in big enough numbers for to survive. I don't think people are really willing to take a chance anymore. They're too stretched, and if they're going to give up, you know, something, it won't be, you know, eaten at home. It'll be eaten out that they give up. So,
well, it's a different way. I'll make one more comment here, and then we'll talk about the market a little bit. Audrey and I go to Fox's Pizza in Orland a lot. We like the people there and stuff. You know, pizza's delicious. So, all of a sudden, about a year ago, they dropped the family size pizza.
Oh no!
Which is, well, the large is still, you know, pretty big, but the family size was big as a bus, basically. And Audrey says, "Well, you know, I can't believe they're doing this." She's actually letting our friend the bartender know that. You know, of course, the bartender, she's not about to. And I go, "Aud, do you have an idea why they did that?" She goes, "Well, they're just trying to." I said, "Look at the menu." By the way, Aud's a very bright lady, but she's not a cost accountant. I said, "Look at the menu." She looks at it, and I go, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Okay, see this pizza, this family-sized pizza? What does it do?" I said, "It feeds a family. So if a husband and wife come in here with 2 kids, and they sit down, and they take up a table, okay, they get this pizza, it's $30, which, you know, it's a reasonable price for a pizza. I mean, it's, you know, way more than you and I used to pay. But that's $7 a person, $7.50 a person. I said, look at the rest of the menu. Is there anything on here for $7.50? There isn't an appetizer that's under $12. And she goes, "I see what you're getting at." I said, "Okay, so then you're going to have 2 Cokes and maybe a couple of drinks each, if you're lucky. And you cannot keep this place open on that tab for that table. It has nothing to do with the price of the pizza or the Coke or the drink. You don't have enough chair. You can't do yep. that. I mean, everybody, that's why when you go into the Tripoli tap or something, if you just say, all right, I'll just do a bowl of chili, which is really good, by the way. A bowl of chili is like $8.50. Well, you can have like dinner for $8.50. I mean, but Nick, you know, it's a family place, and you know, people are going in and out. Some people have a beer and leave or whatever. So he can sort of get away with that. But if you're a restaurant, you can't have anybody eat anything for less than $20. You don't care if it's the best sandwich in the world, a nice dinner, or if it's a bowl of crackers. You need the $20 because somebody's ass is in the seat. It's a whole different way of looking at things that you and I never looked at. But in today's world where overhead is the big thing, that's the way you have to look at stuff, unfortunately. Am I right or wrong?
Well, it's so true, John.
Anyway, we've talked about valuations in the market. We've talked about money supply coming in, keeping the market up. I have a feeling, and it's not just these guys. It's anybody who's ever been a president or Congress leading up to an election. You want the stock market to perform well in the 8 to 12 weeks before the election if you're the incumbent, correct? I mean, duh. You know, nobody wants a stock market, you know, crash a week before the election if you're in power. It's, you know, nobody would want that. You and I wouldn't want that. And we wouldn't want to crash anyway anytime. But at some point, you're gagging everybody, and everybody's sort of get the... When does the lower part of the K get some power? And I'm not saying, you know, go elect people who call themselves socialists. The reason why I don't like those people, John, is not because they call themselves socialists, is they don't even know what it means. That's my issue. I don't even think they know what it means, but which is really bad. You know.
Well, you know, the socialists lost in Wisconsin last night, which wasn't predicted, and maybe that the you know. The role that the socialists have been on has grinding to a halt. It was very low turnout in Wisconsin. Just to take that as an example.
How can it be low turnout with all this high pressure stakes and all this stuff?
You would think, and all the passions, you know, that should be inflaming both sides. But I think it was 25% turnout or something.
So you get on X or some bullshit, and you lob insults at each other, but you can't walk down the block.
But, you know, if the market doesn't like uncertainty, this may be a stabilizing event in that it doesn't look like, you know, a fairly normal state like Wisconsin has drunk the Kool-Aid in big enough quantities to upset the apple cart for the fall. And I don't know to what extent this is a reassurance in the long run, but I do think it's got to tamp down some of the expectations that the country was just going to hell in a handbasket state after state.
If you had a guess, where's there a bigger gap in the Republican Party between the MAGA loyalists and the moderates, or in the Democratic Party between the new, whatever they want to call themselves, socialists and the moderates? It seems to me there's a huge gap in both parties.
Well, yeah, but I think the Democrats is much bigger. And there's a split. You're absolutely right about it being split in the Republicans. It's never healed. It's not likely to go away, you know, anytime soon. But I just think that if you just look at the polarizing forces in the Democratic Party, where they're driving the two sides farther apart, and you know, doing everything they can to humiliate the moderate wing, and the moderate wing is too afraid to take on what would otherwise be a naked assault on their power. I saw a clip yesterday of Jamie Raskin, congressman from Maryland, who was on some forum, and he's releasing an ad. This is something that's got his name on it. I don't think he has any concerns about being reelected, but you could tell by the tone of what he was saying that it was all about, I don't think socialists are so bad. A lot of them they're not like this wing of the socialists. They're more like, I mean, he's telling people who he thinks socialists are, and I think it's his way of
I've been doing all that myself. Just because somebody wants everybody to get cheaper medical care doesn't make him a socialist.
Well, that too. But he was doing it purely out of self-preservation, because he's somebody that in any other kind of situation could easily be primary, just like a lot of the other, rock-solid, traditional liberal Democrats have been Goldman in New York, and you name it. These people are afraid not to butter up these people because they know they've got the power.
Well,
to
I mean, look how many moderate Republicans are afraid of Trump. Same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, his coattails have been, you know, certainly, you know, ruined it for the diehards. But I would say that the drift of the party has definitely been towards Trump. It has been since before 2016. He's going back to the
well, what name days. We got a dash here, but what name would you use since you're a wordsmith? If say you're me, okay, and I look at the economy we have now and I'm pretty much appalled by it in terms of the lack of competition, the plutocracy, if you don't have your nose up the ass of government, you don't get the contract from what I'm seeing. This is nowhere near the liberal capitalism that I have pretty much spent my whole life loving. I'm no socialist, I'm no communist. Where does that put me? There needs to be a name for this plutocracy meets kleptocracy that I'm seeing. It doesn't. I want to go back to the capitalism that I know. Where does that put me? It doesn't make me a socialist, but I think this sucks and have for a long time. Where am I on here? Do I don't even have any.
Probably the nearest label would be dinosaur or Neanderthal or something like that. And I'm probably in that group.
You're probably right too. I mean,
a slightly different faction of it, but yeah, you would be so out of the mainstream and so reviled by the progressives on both sides of it. You know, the ones who were the clear-eyed, you know, people who think they have the solutions to everything wrong. This direction, the 180 degrees opposite, but I'd be very much closer to the center.
I want people to go out and have an idea, be able to get a loan like other people and not just the big people. I want people to be able to start up a small business. I want people to get some kind of clarity of their government, of what the laws are going to be going forward. I want people to use the stock market to raise money. I want to be able to use the bond market and banks to raise cash. I want it the way it's supposed to be. Where does that put me, other than a Luddite?
There's no party for that.
That's scary. Why am I wasting all of our time on the air every day trying to help?
But to pick up what you and Kevin were saying earlier, I'd like people to go to college and get an education for life, where they didn't feel like they were cheated in any way just because they didn't get the dream job that they thought college would qualify them for. And, make it affordable enough so that people who wanted to go to college and would get a lot out of it have the opportunity, and they're not bankrupt because of it, or they're not endlessly deferring getting married, and then they have the chance to buy a house, too, which all of these things sound like the most normal, everyday things that both parties would agree on. And yet, if you want those things, there's no place, really, in any of the parties, I think, where you can find a road back to where that was the norm. I don't know how we can get back there, because there's too much that's just gotten, we're sickened by all this stuff to a point that.
By the way, you're not the first. When I was running for the board, when I didn't win, I said I want to keep competition in the market, even if it's not on the floor. I want to be able people to have the markets to be open and competitive. And this guy of Asian descent looks at me and goes, "You dinosaur." So you're not the first one to call me that. You dinosaur. I remember that to this day. So I guess wanting something to be a competitive, a laissez-faire, not as maybe as far as hell, but a laissez-faire competitive place where people can actually make their own decisions. I guess me dinosaur. What can I tell you?
You can be the brontosaurus. I'll be the stegosaurus.
You want to be the guy with the teeth. Anyway, on that happy note, S&P futures up 36, NASDAQ futures up 293. We're evidently buying the CPI number. Again, 3.4 year over year, 0.1 last month over month. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.